in my room. Michael suggested a prayer. Everyone, including the two nurses, joined hands around the bed, and Michael made one more heartfelt plea for my return to health. Lord, bring Evan back to us. I know it's in your power. Still, no one knew who had called Michael, but whoever it was, it's a good thing they did. Because the prayers coming to me from the world below, the world I'd started out from, were finally starting to get through. Chapter 18. To Forget and to Remember. My awareness was larger now. So large it seemed to take in the entire universe. Have you ever listened to a song on a static-filled radio station? You get used to it. Then someone adjusts the dial, and you hear the same song in its full clarity. How could you have failed to notice how dim, how far away, how entirely untrue to the original it was before? Of course, that's how the mind works. Humans are built to adapt. I'd explained to my patients many times that this or that discomfort would lessen, or at least seem to lessen, as their bodies and brains adapted to the new situation. Something goes on long enough and your brain learns to ignore it, or work around it, or just to treat it as normal. But our limited earthly consciousness is far from simply normal, and I was getting my first illustration of this as I traveled ever deeper to the very heart of the core. I still remembered nothing of my earthly past, and yet I was not the less for this. Even though I'd forgotten my life down here, I had remembered who I really and truly was out there. I was a citizen of a universe staggering in its vastness and complexity, and ruled entirely by love. In an almost eerie way, my discoveries beyond the body echoed the lessons I had learned just a year earlier through reconnecting with my birth family. Ultimately, none of us are orphans. We are all in the position I was, in that we have other family, beings who are watching and looking out for us, beings we have momentarily forgotten, but who, if we open ourselves to their presence, are waiting to help us navigate our time here on Earth. None of us are ever unloved. Each and every one of us is deeply known and cared for by a Creator who cherishes us beyond any ability we have to comprehend. That knowledge must no longer remain a secret. Chapter 19. Nowhere to Hide. By Friday, my body had been on triple intravenous antibiotics for 4 full days, but still wasn't responding. Family and friends had come from all over, and those who hadn't come had initiated prayer groups at their churches. My sister-in-law, Peggy, and Holly's close friend, Sylvia, arrived that afternoon. Holly greeted them with as cheerful a face as she could muster. Betsy and Phyllis continued to champion the "he's going to be fine" view, to remain positive at all costs. But each day it got harder to believe. Even Betsy herself began to wonder if her no negativity in the room order really meant something more like no reality in the room. "Do you think Evan would do this for us if the roles were reversed?" Phyllis asked Betsy that morning after another largely... around the subject on everyone's mind, that I, the absent guest of honor, would most likely never return to this house again. Holly had returned to the hospital to continue the endless vigil. She sat by my bed holding my hand and kept repeating the mantras suggested by Susan Wrenches, forcing herself to stay with the meaning of the words as she said them and to believe in her heart that they were true. "Receive the prayers. You have healed others. Now is your time to be healed. You are loved by many. Your body knows what to do. It is not yet your time to die." Chapter 20. The Closing. Each time I found myself stuck again in the coarse earthworm's eye view, I was able to remember the brilliant spinning melody which opened the portal back to the gateway and the core. I spent great stretches of time, which paradoxically felt like no time at all, in the presence of my guardian angel on the butterfly's wing, and an eternity learning lessons from the Creator and the orb of light deep in the core. At some point, I came up to the edge of the gateway and found that I could not re-enter it. The spinning melody, up to then my ticket into those higher regions, would no longer take me there. The gates of heaven were closed. Once again, describing what this felt like is challenging in the extreme, thanks to the bottleneck of linear language that we have to force everything through here on earth, and the general flattening of experience that happens when we're in the body. Think of every time you've ever experienced disappointment. There is a sense in which all the losses that we undergo here on earth are in truth variations of one absolutely central loss, the loss of heaven. On the day that the doors of heaven were closed to me, I felt a sense of sadness unlike any I had ever known. Emotions are different up there. All the human emotions are present, but they're deeper, more spacious. They're not just inside, but outside as well. Imagine that every time your mood changed here on earth, the weather changed instantly along with it. That your tears would bring on a torrential downpour, and your joy would make the clouds instantly disappear. That gives a hint of how much more vast and consequential changes of mood feel like up there. How strangely and powerfully what we think of as inside and outside don't really exist at all. So it was that I, heartbroken, now sank into a world of ever-increasing sorrow, a gloom that was at the same time an actual sinking. I moved down through great walls of clouds. There was murmuring all around me, but I couldn't understand the words. Then I realized that countless beings were surrounding me, kneeling in arcs that spread into the distance. Looking back on it now, I realized what these half-seen, half-sensed hierarchies of beings stretching out into the dark above and below were doing. They were praying for me. Two of the faces I remembered later were those of Michael Sullivan and his wife Paige. I recall seeing them in profile only, but I clearly identified them after my return when language came back. Michael had physically been in the ICU room leading prayers numerous times, but Paige was never physically there, although she had said prayers for me too. These prayers gave me energy. That's probably why, profoundly sad as I was, something in me felt a strange confidence that everything would be all right. These beings knew I was undergoing a transition, and they were singing and praying to help me keep my spirits up. I was headed into the unknown, but by that point I had complete faith and trust that I would be taken care of, as my companion on the butterfly wing and the infinitely loving deity had promised. That wherever I went, heaven would come with me. It would come in the form of the Creator, of Om, and it would come in the form of the angel, my angel, the girl on the butterfly wing. I was on the way back, but I was not alone, and I knew I'd never feel alone again. Chapter 21, The Rainbow. Thinking about it later, Phyllis said that the one thing she remembered above all else about that week was the rain. A cold, driving rain from low-hanging clouds that never let up and never let the sun peek through. But then, that Sunday morning as she pulled her car into the hospital parking lot, something strange happened. Phyllis had just read a text message from one of the prayer groups in Boston saying, "Expect a miracle." As she pondered just how much of a miracle she should expect, she helped Mom step out of their car, and they both commented that the rain had stopped. To the east, the sun was shooting its rays through a chink in the cloud cover, lighting up the lovely, ancient mountains to the west and the layer of cloud above as well, giving the gray clouds a golden tinge. Then, looking toward the distant peaks, opposite to where the mid-November sun was starting its ascent, there it was, a perfect rainbow. Sylvia drove to the hospital with Holly and Bond for a pre-arranged meeting with my main doctor, Scott Wade. Dr. Wade was also a friend and a neighbor and had been wrestling with the worst decision that doctors dealing with life-threatening illnesses ever face. The longer I stayed in coma, the more likely it became that I would spend the rest of my life in a persistent vegetative state. Given the high likelihood that I might still succumb to the meningitis if they simply stopped the antibiotics, it might be more sensible to cease using them, rather than to continue treatment in the face of almost certain lifelong coma. Given that my meningitis had not responded at all well to treatment, they were running the risk that they might finally eradicate my meningitis only to enable me to live for months or years as a once vital, now unresponsive body, with zero quality of life. "Have a seat," Dr. Wade told Sylvia and Holly in a tone that was kind, but also unmistakably grim. Dr. Brennan and I have each had conference calls with experts at Duke, the University of Virginia, and Bowman Gray Medical Schools. And I have to tell you that everyone, too. Chapter 22, Six Faces. As I descended, more faces bubbled out of the muck, just as they always did when I was moving down into the realm of the earthworm's eye view. But there was something different about the faces this time. They were human now, not animal. And they were very clearly saying things. Not that I could make out what they were saying. It was a bit like the old Charlie Brown cartoons, when the adults speak and all you hear are indecipherable sounds. Later, upon looking back on it, I realized I could actually identify six of the faces that I saw. There was Sylvia, there was Holly and her sister Peggy, there was Scott Wade, and there was Susan Wrenches. Of these, the only one who was not actually physically present at my bedside in those final hours was Susan. But in her way, she had, of course, been by my bedside too, because that night, as the night before, she had sat down in her home in Chapel Hill and willed herself into my presence. Later, learning about this, I was puzzled that my mother Betty and my sisters, who had been there all week, holding my hand lovingly for endless hours, were absent from the faces I'd seen. Mom had been suffering from a stress fracture in her foot, using a walker to ambulate, but she had faithfully taken her turn in the vigil. Phyllis, Betsy, and Jean had all been there. Then I learned that they had not been present that final night. The faces I remembered were those who were physically there the seventh morning of my coma, or the evening before. Again, though, at the time, as I made the descent, I had no names or identities to attach to any of these faces. I only knew or sensed that they were important to me in some way. One more in particular drew me toward it with special power. It began to tug at me, with a jolt that seemed to echo up and down the whole vast well of clouds and praying angelic beings through which I was descending. I suddenly realized that the beings of the gateway and the core, beings I had known and loved seemingly forever, were not the only beings I knew. I knew and loved beings down below me, too, down in the realm I was fast approaching, beings I had, until now, completely forgotten. This knowledge focused on all six faces, but in particular on the sixth one. It was so familiar. I realized with a feeling of shock, bordering on absolute fear, that whoever it was the face of someone who needed me. Someone who would never recover if I left. If I abandoned it, the loss would be unbearable, like the feeling I got when the gates to heaven had closed. It would be a betrayal I simply couldn't commit. Up to that point, I had been free. I had journeyed through worlds in the way that adventurers most effectively can, without any real concern about their fate. The outcome didn't ultimately matter, because even when I was in the core, there was never any worry or guilt about letting anyone down. That had, of course, been one of the first things that I'd learned when I was with the girl on the butterfly wing, and she told me, "There is nothing you can do that is wrong." But now it was different. So different that for the first time in my entire voyage, I felt remarkable terror. It was a terror not for myself, but for these faces, in particular for that sixth face. A face that I still couldn't identify, but that I knew was crucially important to me. This face took on ever greater detail, until at last I saw that he, was actually pleading for me to return, to risk the terrible descent into the world below to be with him again. I still could not understand his words, but somehow they conveyed that I had a stake in this world below, that I had, as they say, skin in the game. It mattered that I returned. I had ties here, ties that I had to honor. The clearer the face became, the more I realized this, and the closer I came to recognizing the face of a young boy. Chapter 23, Final Night, First Morning. Before sitting down with Dr. Wade, Polly told Bond to wait outside the door because she hadn't wanted him to hear what she feared was very bad news. But sensing this, Bond had lingered outside the door and caught some of Dr. Wade's words, enough of them to understand the real situation, to understand that his father was not, in fact, coming back, ever. But now, as Sylvia and Bond stared into my slack face, resolutely refusing to accept what they had just heard from the doctor, something happened. My eyes opened. Sylvia shrieked. She would later tell me that the next biggest shock, almost as shocking as my eyes opening, was the way they immediately began to look around. Up, down, here, there. They reminded her not of an adult emerging from a 7-day coma, but of an infant. Someone newly born to the world, looking around at it, taking it in for the first time. In a way, she was right. Sylvia recovered from her initial flat-out shock and realized that I was agitated by something. She ran out of the room to where Holly was still standing at the big picture window talking to Evan IV. "Holly, Holly," Sylvia shouted. "He's awake, awake! Tell Evan his dad is coming back!" Holly stared at Sylvia. "Evan?" she said into the phone. "I have to call you back. Your father is coming back to life." Holly walked, then ran into the ICU, with Dr. Wade right behind her. Sure enough, I was thrashing around on the bed. Not mechanically, but because I was conscious, and something was clearly bothering me. Dr. Wade immediately understood what it was, the breathing tube that was still in my throat. The tube I no longer needed, because my brain, along with the rest of my body, had just kicked back to life. He reached over, cut the securing tape, and carefully extracted it. I choked a little, gasped down my first fully unaided lungful of air in 7 days, and spoke the first words I'd spoken in a week as well. "Thank you." Phyllis was still thinking about the rainbow she'd just seen when she exited the elevator. She was pushing Mom in a wheelchair. They walked into the room, and Phyllis almost fell over backward in disbelief. I was sitting up in my bed, meeting their gaze with my own. Betsy was jumping up and down. She hugged Phyllis. They were both in tears. Phyllis came closer and looked deep into my eyes. I looked back at her, and around at everyone else. As my loving family and caregivers gathered around my bed, still dumbstruck by the inexplicable transition, I had a peaceful, joyous smile. "All is well," I said, radiating that blissful message as much as speaking the words. I looked at each of them, deeply, acknowledging the divine miracle of our very existence. "Don't worry, all is well," I repeated to assuage any doubt. Phyllis told me later that it was as if I were imparting a crucial message from the beyond, that the world is as it should be, that we have nothing to fear. She said she often recalls that moment when she is vexed by some earthly concern, to find comfort in knowing that we are never alone. As I took stock of the entourage, I seemed to be returning to my earthly existence. "What," I asked those who were assembled, "are you doing here?" To which Phyllis replied, "What are you doing here?" Chapter 24, The Return. Bond had envisioned his same old dad would wake up, take a look around, and just need a little catching up on what had happened before resuming my role as the father he'd always known. He soon discovered, however, that it wasn't going to be quite that easy. Dr. Wade cautioned Bond about two things. First, he shouldn't count on my remembering anything I was saying as I emerged from the coma. He explained that the process of memory takes enormous brain power, and that my brain wasn't sufficiently recovered to be performing at that sophisticated level. Second, he shouldn't worry much about what I said during these early days, because a lot of it was going to sound pretty crazy. He proved right on both counts. That first morning back, Bond proudly showed me the drawing he and Evan IV had made of my white blood cells attacking the E. coli bacteria. "Wow, wonderful," I said. Bond glowed with pride and excitement. Then I continued, "What are the conditions like outside? What does the computer readout say? You need to move. I'm getting ready to jump." Bond's face fell. Needless to say, this was not the full return he had been hoping for. I was having wild delusions, reliving some of the most exciting times of my life in the most vivid fashion. In my mind, I was on jump run, ready to skydive out of a DC-3 3 miles above the Earth, going to be the last man out, my favorite position. It was the maximal flying of my body. Bursting into brilliant sunshine outside the airplane door, I immediately assumed a head dive with my arms tucked behind me in my mind, feeling the familiar buffeting as I fell beneath the prop blast, watching from upside down as the belly of the enormous silvery plane started to shoot skyward, its huge propellers whirling in slow motion, earth and clouds below mirrored on its underbelly. I was musing over the odd sight of flaps and wheels down as if landing while still miles above the ground, all to slow down and minimize wind shock to the exiting jumpers. I tucked my arms in extra tight in a head-down dive to accelerate briskly to over 220 miles per hour, nothing more than my speckled blue helmet and shoulders against thin upper air to resist the tug of the huge planet below, moving more than the length of a football field every second, the wind roaring by furiously at thrice hurricane speed, louder than anything ever. Passing between the tops of two enormous puffy white clouds, I rocketed into the clear chasm between them, green earth and sparkling deep blue sea far below, in my wild, thrilling rush down to join my friends, just barely visible, in the colorful snowflake formation growing larger every second as other jumpers joined in far, far below. I was flipping back and forth between being present there in the ICU and being out of my mind in the adrenaline-soaked delusions of a gorgeous skydive. I was between nutty and getting it. For 2 days, I blabbered about skydiving, airplanes, and the Internet to all who would listen. As my physical brain gradually recovered its bearings, I entered a strange and exhausting paranoid universe. I became obsessed with an ugly background of Internet messages that would show up whenever I closed my eyes, and that sometimes appeared on the ceiling when they were open. When I shut my eyes, I heard grinding, monotonous, anti-melodious chanting sounds that usually went away when I opened them again. I kept putting my finger in the air, pointing, just like E.T., trying to guide the Internet ticker flowing past me in Russian, Chinese. In short, I was a little crazy. It was all a little like the realm of the Earthworm's eye view, only more nightmarish, because what I heard and saw was laced with the trappings of my human past. I recognized my family members even when, as in Holly's case, I didn't remember their names. But at the same time, it completely lacked the astonishing clarity and vibrant richness, the ultra-reality of the gateway and the core. I was most definitely back in my brain. Despite that initial moment of seemingly full lucidity, when my eyes first opened, I soon once again had no memory of my human life before coma. My only memory was of where I had just been, the rough, ugly realm of the Earthworm's eye view, the idyllic gateway, and the awesome heavenly core. My mind, my real self, was squeezing its way back into the all-too-tight and limiting suit of physical existence, with its spatio-temporal bounds, its linear thought, and its limitation to verbal communication. Things that, up until a week ago, I thought were the only mode of existence around, but which now showed themselves as extraordinarily cumbersome limitations. Physical life is characterized by defensiveness, whereas spiritual life is just the opposite. This is the only explanation I could come up with to explain why my re-entry had such a strong, paranoid aspect to it. For a stretch of time, I became convinced that Holly, whose name I still didn't know but whom I somehow recognized as my wife, and my physicians were trying to kill me. I had further dreams and fantasies about flight and skydiving, some of them extremely long and involved. In the longest, most intense, and almost ridiculously detailed of these, I found myself in a South Florida cancer clinic featuring outdoor escalators where I was pursued by Holly, two South Florida police officers, and a pair of Asian ninja photographers on cable pulleys. I was, in fact, going through something called ICU psychosis. It's normal, even expected, for patients whose brains are coming back online after being inactive for a long period. I'd seen it many a time, but never from the inside. And from the inside, it was very, very different indeed. The most interesting thing about this session of nightmares and paranoid fantasies, in retrospect, is that all of it was indeed that, a fantasy. Portions of it, in particular the extended South Florida ninja nightmare, were extremely intense and even outright terrifying while happening. But in retrospect, indeed almost immediately after this period ended, it all became clearly recognizable as what it was, something cooked up by my very beleaguered brain as it was trying to recover its bearings. Some of the dreams I had during this period were stunningly and frighteningly vivid. But in the end, they served only to underline how very, very dissimilar my dream state had been compared with the ultra-reality deep in coma. As for the rockets, airplanes, and skydiving themes that I imagined so consistently, they were, I later realized, quite accurate from a symbolic point of view. Because the fact was that I was making a dangerous re-entry from a place far away, to the abandoned but now once again functional space station of my brain. One could hardly ask for a better earthly analogy for what happened to me during my week out of body on a rocket launch. Chapter 25. Not There Yet. Bond wasn't the only one having difficulty accepting the decidedly kooky person I was during those first days back. The day after I recovered consciousness, Monday, Phyllis called Evan IV on his computer using Skype. "Evan, here's your dad," she said, turning the video camera toward me. "Hi, Dad, how's it going?" he said cheerfully. For a minute, I just grinned and stared at the computer screen. When I finally spoke, Evan was crushed. I was painfully slow in my speech, and the words themselves made little sense. Evan later told me, "You sounded like a zombie, like someone on a bad acid trip." Unfortunately, he had not been forewarned about the possibility of an ICU psychosis. Gradually, my paranoia abated, and my thinking and conversation became more lucid. 2 days after my awakening, I was transferred to the neuroscience step-down unit. The nurses there gave Phyllis and Bessie cots so that they could sleep next to me. I trusted no one but the two of them. They made me feel safe, tethered to my new reality. The only problem was that I didn't sleep. I kept them up all night going on about the internet, space stations, Russian double agents, and all manner of related nonsense. Phyllis tried to convince the nurses that I had a little cough, hoping a little cough syrup would bring on an hour or so of uninterrupted sleep. I was like a newborn who did not adhere to a sleep schedule. In my quieter moments, Phyllis and Bessie helped pull me slowly back to Earth. They recalled all kinds of stories from our childhood, and though by and large I listened as if I were hearing them for the first time, I was fascinated all the same. The more they talked, the more something important began to glimmer inside me, the realization that I had, in fact, been there for these events myself. Very quickly, both sisters told me later, the brother they had known became visible again through the thick fog of paranoid chatter. "It was amazing," Betsy later told me. "You were just coming out of coma. You weren't at all fully aware of where you were or what was going on. You talked about all kinds of crazy stuff half the time, and yet your sense of humor was just fine. It was obviously you. You were back." One of the first things you did was crack a joke about feeding yourself, Phyllis later confided. We were prepared to have fed you spoonful by spoonful for as long as it took, but you'd have none of it. You were determined to get that orange jello into your mouth on your own. As the temporarily stunned engines of my brain kicked back in ever further, I would watch myself say or do things and marvel, where did that come from? Early on, a Lynchburg friend named Jackie came by to visit. Holly and I had known Jackie and her husband Ron well, having bought our house from them. Without my willing them to do so, my deeply ingrained Southern social graces kicked in. Seeing Jackie, I immediately asked, how's Ron? After a few more days, I started having occasional, genuinely lucid conversations with my visitors. And again, it was fascinating to see how much of these connections were automatic and did not require much effort on my part. Like a jet on autopilot, my brain somehow negotiated these increasingly familiar landscapes of human experience. I was getting a first-hand demonstration of a truth that I'd known very well as a neurosurgeon. The brain is a truly marvelous mechanism. Of course, the unspoken question on everybody's mind, including mine in my more lucid moments, was, how well would I get? Was I really returning in full, or had the E. coli done at least some of the damage all the doctors had been sure it would do? This daily waiting tore at everyone, especially Holly, who feared that all of a sudden the miraculous progress would stop, and she would be left with only a portion of the me she had known. Yet day by day, ever more of that me returned. Language, memories, recognition, a certain mischievous streak I've always been known for returned as well. And while they were pleased to see my sense of humor back, my two sisters weren't always thrilled with how I chose to use it. Monday afternoon, Phyllis touched my forehead, and I recoiled. Ouch! I screamed. That hurts! Then, after enjoying everybody's horrified expressions, I said, just kidding. Everyone was surprised by the speed of my recovery, except for me. I, as of yet, had no real clue how close to death I had actually been. As one by one, friends and family headed back to their lives, I wished them well and remained blissfully ignorant of the tragedy that had been so narrowly averted. I was so ebullient that one of the neurologists who evaluated me for rehab placement insisted that I was too euphoric, and that I was probably suffering from brain damage. This doctor, like me, was a regular bow tie wearer, and I returned the favor of his diagnosis by telling my sisters, after he had left, that he was strangely flat of affect for a bow tie aficionado. Even then, I knew something that more and more of the people around me would come to accept as well. Doctor's views or no doctor's views, I wasn't sick or brain damaged. I was completely well. In fact, though at this point only I knew this, I was completely and truly well for the first time in my entire life.